good for me. So I, in the process, have gotten 4 peer certificates. I want to work in peer support and help people that are in any situation, mental health, drugs and alcohol. I mean, I basically cover it all the levels. So that's my goal in the real near future, probably next year, is I want to be working with people.
If there is someone listening that is struggling right now, do you have any messages to give them hope and encourage them to seek support?
Don't fall into despair. There's always light ahead of the road. Just be patient with yourself. Know that there's people out there who do care about you, that care about whether you live or die. Just know that there are support groups, there are resources, and they are here for you. They will always be here for you.
To those up there, all I can say, they give yourself a chance. You deserve better. It's a better life, you know. Give yourself a chance.
You're not defined by every bad choice that you make, by every drug that you took. You're somebody who's worth saving. It may seem hopeless right now, but the help is out there. And please, please, just no matter where you are in your addiction, anything like that, just know that if you want it bad enough, you're going to be able to succeed.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, and thank you for listening.
This is Daffodil. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Got troubles. I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, can say it through. Cause you got a friend in me.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. This issue that we're going to discuss has been bubbling, and it's going to have long-term consequences. There are actually two, but it's all centered around the way that we communicate. The other thing, and closely connected, is the move that's being made by Facebook. And we've already seen this de facto move with other social outlets in terms of not having fact checkers. In the case of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, he wants to move a lot of his operation to Texas to avoid the appearance of being too liberal. And what is that going to mean when you have the largest platform that has not millions but billions of people on there? Joining us are folks who have boots on the ground, 10 toes down. We have Steve Renderos from the Center of Media Justice. He heads that wonderful organization up. We also have media critic, author, independent journalist, and somebody working on a book that deals directly with media. Her name is Jennifer Posner, so this is not her first rodeo in matters like this. And then joining us is somebody who we all know for his work as an artist, CB, a.k.a. Chris Berger. We know him for the Love Phenomenon projects. But a lot of people don't know, like many people in the Bay who do art, he's also a tech guy. And when he's not rapping on the mic, he's sitting up here with youngsters in the cuts, teaching them the ins and outs of tech, getting them online. And so he's well versed in this. So welcome to the show. And Steve, Center of Media Justice, I want to start off with you. Let's start off with net neutrality. Why should we be concerned? Can you kind of give us a net neutrality 101 for people who don't know? And what does this latest appeals court ruling mean for us?
Right on. Thanks for having me, Davey. I mean, net neutrality in its most simplest form is just the way that the internet has more or less operated since its inception, this open space where all voices are treated equally. And net neutrality as an idea, but also as a set of policies, has ensured that stays true. I consider myself a veteran of the net neutrality fights, because we've been fighting for net neutrality now for, you know, well over 20 years, and have won some things, have lost some things. The most recent, just to catch folks up, back in 2015, the Federal Communications Commission passed a set of net neutrality rules that codified that idea of, like, the internet being this open space where all voices are treated equally, made that the rule of the land at a national level. Post the election of Donald Trump and his ascendancy, his FCC, because the FCC kind of flips when there's a change in the administration, they repealed those rules. And you saw states across the country, including California, step up and pass their own state versions of net neutrality rules. And then under this current administration, under Biden, his FCC reinstituted net neutrality. So this court challenge that we're seeing right now is a challenge to those rules that were most recently updated by the FCC that's being run by Jessica Rosenworcel, Chairperson Jessica Rosenworcel. It's important because it's been the thing that's ensured that the predatory behaviors, the bad practices of large corporations, like big internet service providers, that they're prevented from manipulating the internet in such a way that allows them to extract more profit. They're already doing that in many of the ways that they operate, right? Like through where they choose to build high quality, high speed internet, where they build the infrastructure. There's a lot of digital discrimination that happens with that. Now, if they, net neutrality prevented them from creating fast lanes and slow lanes online that, created first class citizens and second class citizens on access to our internet. So now with that going away, it's basically free reins here for corporations like Comcast, like Verizon, to extract more money out of the internet, while it's us who have to pay the cost for, pay more money for internet for less quality than we've been accustomed to. So it's a big deal. I think symbolically, there's also, bigger things at stake, which is one of the things that the court ruling essentially does is it strips the Federal Communications Commission from authority to regulate the internet. And that's a huge deal. That's like saying this institution that was designed to be the gatekeeper against, the bad behaviors of these big corporations, they no longer have any authority to do anything against these big corporations. So that's the other, I think, big consequence of what happened here.
Let me add this, and then I'll bring in Jennifer to get some thoughts on this. I've always explained this to people, and I think now that we've been through, these contested elections, conversations about what's going on in Gaza. So we're now used to seeing shadow banning, people being throttled and all that, right? So we've seen on social media slow and fast lanes, whose information gets to float to the top and who doesn't. And I've always explained that on the internet, what it meant is that if you, Steve, was the New York Times and me, Davey D, was Hard Knock Radio, we were both one click away from Jennifer Posner, right? She come on the line, she click, there's your site, the New York Times, here's click, there's Davey D. But when the elimination of net neutrality does, it means that click, there's you, the New York Times, click, 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 maybe five times to get to me. And the insidious aspect of that is that me, as the content creator, I don't know that Jennifer is 3,000 miles away and she can't access my site, you know, without doing 5 clicks. I'm thinking I did everything I could on my end, but she's like, man, it takes 5 clicks. Let me just go to the New York Times. So there's that sort of priority. And the fear that we had is not only do you have the ability now to move everybody at different clicks away from content, now they may come along and go, well, Dave, if you want Jennifer to reach you, you can do that by paying an extra $500 a month, which falls in the hands of billionaires and the rich folks. And I'll close by saying the very reason so many of us went on the internet was it was a democratizing force. So if we saw Fox News or the New York Times, we could be right on par with them, 1 click away. And now that is being stripped. And I hope people kind of understand that, in lieu of seeing how some of our content on social media, which is privately run, has been throttled and some have been able to rise. So if I talk about craziness on Facebook, it goes viral. I say, you know, stop the genocide in Gaza, doesn't see the light of day. You know, I even want to talk about sports. It doesn't do that because now they monetize that. Like, if you want to talk about sports, well, that's a paid thing. So I appreciate you breaking that down. Jennifer is a media critic, somebody who has had to wrestle long with equality in this space. How do you see the net neutrality thing? What's your concerns and thoughts?
So, like Stephen, I'm also a veteran of the net neutrality wars. In the early 2000s, I founded the first national feminist media justice organization, Women in Media and News. And Women in Media and News and CMJ and Free Press and lots of community organizations that were accountability media organizations across the country have been working around net neutrality for you know, more than 20 years. And one of the ways that I always explained it, I really love, Davey, your metaphor about the sort of throttling on social media to like a one-to-one to the potential throttling of sites on the internet. One of the ways that I always explained it, your example was with artists, right? One of the things I've always talked about is around journalism. And we all know, at least I think folks who listen to Hard Knock Radio understand that independent, non-commercial, non-fettered journalism and analysis, from investigative reporting to research-based analysis, are absolutely crucial to the healthy functioning of democracy. You cannot have a healthy democracy without that.
Right.
And one of the things that my organization, Women in Media and News, when I used to run it, was focused on was increasing diversity of sources, both women in general and women of color in particular, as news sources, as news creators, as voices that you'd hear, whether it was on front page reporting or in commentary sections or as pundits on TV shows, et cetera. When I first started, when I was working at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting in the late 90s, women were around, I don't remember the exact number, like 7%, 9% of op-ed writers.
Wow.
And almost never, just completely invisible from cable news, debate shows, Sunday morning talk shows, that sort of thing. And the reason that has changed, the reason that, for example, Melissa Harris Perry ever had a show on MSNBC, the reason that we have women of color in particular, people of color in particular, talking on cable news, on broadcast news, the reason that we hear women and people of color's voices in corporate newspapers is because for about 10 years, the feminist blogosphere started to build power. And this is a story I used to tell when I would, rallies outside the FCC in coalition. I always talked about how net neutrality was incredibly important to keep the toothpaste from going back in the tube. And what I mean by that, most people think of the first mass shooting in this country, mass school shooting, as Columbine. No. I started pitching around a story in 1998, the year before Columbine. It was a middle school. Two boys took a gun to school, ushered out the male classmates, shot the female teacher and all the girls in their class, or a bunch of girls in their class. And this was the first major shooting. And because it was that, we hadn't seen all of it before, you know, corporate media, which we had not only was dominant, the only dominant voice, there were more newspapers. There was local news, right? So national news, regional news, local news, all were out of control covering it. In, you know, what could possibly have made this happen? This is a school shooting. Who, what could possibly, it must be gangster rap. It must be the breakdown. Yeah. The family. It must be this, 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 and this. It must be, you know, remember Tipper Gore and her music lyrics, all of that, right? It, all of those things. The one thing they didn't say was something that I found in, like, after the jump, one comment that no stories repeated, which was that one of the boys said, "No girl is going to break up with me." He was aggrieved, and he went to school, and they shot a bunch of girls, and that was not part of the story. Right. So I tried to pitch a story to everywhere. I pitched it to all the major, you know, top newspapers. No one wanted it. I was a hysterical feminist. I was overreacting. Why am I playing the gender card? All that BS. Right. So right. I wrote about it for a feminist newspaper, Dearly Departed. We don't have any of those anymore, called Sojourner, the Women's Forum. And I headlined it, and they kept the headline, Jonesboro, Arkansas. Jonesboro, sexism kills girls. And then I had to write a version of that story over and over and over again, dozen times or more, every time a usually white, not always, but usually white man or boy took a gun to a school or a bank or Amish country or government building or college campus and shot it up because he had domestic violence in his background, just like we've seen this past month, or he had sexual assault in his background, or he had a manifesto he left online about killing all the girls because they wouldn't sleep with him, like with the Elliot Rodgers situation that everybody always ignored. And my post in 98, my article in 98 said, if news didn't cover this proper context of misogyny in the histories of these shooters, we as journalists and an industry would be complicit because no one would know the warning signs, right?
Right.
So then for 10 years, after that, I start writing in the feminist blogosphere in addition to the articles. Other bloggers start retweeting it, start sharing it. They all start writing about it also. By 16 years later, when Elliot Rodger leaves the manifesto, Melissa Harris Perry finally has a show. She does a segment that I was waiting to speak about for more than 15 years. She had me on. It was called something about it, named this as domestic terrorism, which was about gender-based terrorism. I talked about you. This would not happen. None of this understanding of toxic masculinity would have happened. We wouldn't know the warning signs if we didn't have 10 years of internet independent journalists and bloggers talking about the stuff that corporate media wouldn't allow us to platform. I kept saying, we don't regulate the, if we let this become a wild west with fast lanes and slow lanes, they put the toothpaste back in the tube. They don't need to hire us anymore and keep women's voices and people of color's voices in corporate news if there's if there's no way for us to easily get to people online, right? That's the only reason they hire us.
I think Jennifer Posner, that's her voice if you're just tuning in. What you described, and that applies, you know, we can pull up dozens of examples that parallel what you're talking about, is really the challenge we had. If we're going back to 98, the internet was not big in the way that it is now. You didn't even have social media. And so for a lot of people who are younger, it wasn't the way it is now. It wasn't easily accessible. It was expensive, et cetera, et cetera. So trying to get a story across or a political viewpoint was very arduous, and you kept running into brick walls. And so the point that we were making, you found this democratizing agent in the internet, and your voice was right next to the New York Times, right next to the Daily News, right next to CNN. And so you were always that one click away, and we could get your information. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and it's a, it, I, We absolutely were. You're so right, one click away. But in the media literacy graphic novel I have coming out next year, I actually interview Joe Torres from
Free Press, yeah,
and, Media 2070 Project, and we talk about this. And we were talking about how it's not quite. It's the same. They're all running on the same race, right? All the independent voices and the corporate voices, but. Even before fast lanes and slow lanes, those with, you know, multi-million dollar resources versus those with $10, there's right. like velvet ropes. It's the same race, but it's a slightly different track. With net neutrality right. going away, it's not even the same race anymore.
No, real talk, and I appreciate that. Chris Berger, I want to bring you in, and I want to ask you to wear a couple of hats. Hat one, as an artist, and as somebody like yourself who, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, they would consider you a underground artist, even though you're one of the pioneering figures here in the Bay. So the internet has been important for you and so many others who, you know, didn't have payola to get on commercial radio, didn't have these resources yet, but you can do a show right now and it will sell out. It will be packed. And a lot of that has to do with the online presence. We've already started to see the fasting and slow laning of that. You know, like, let's give priority to these major label artists. You know, let's make sure when I go on, say, YouTube, and I click and it goes artists to be recommended, even though I've known you for, you know, 30 years and have all your records and play them, you don't show up in my recommendations. It's a bought and paid for recommendation, so I get Snoop and, you know, and Lotto and City Girls and Megan and everybody else but you. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that becomes concerning. So you're already starting to see that. I'm fearful that those type of those discrepancies is going to increase more. But how do you see that? And then my second question is, how do the youth that you work with and train and build with, how are they seeing the media landscape? Are they aware of the net neutralities and concerns, or is it for them business as usual? This is all they've known, because they're much younger.
Yeah, I want to say I'm very thankful to be on with you all today, Jennifer and Stephen. Great to meet you. I often tell my students, and thank you, Davey. I often tell my students the most important network is the human network. And as a, you know, back in the 70s, I was a paper boy in Oakland. I used to deliver the paper, you know, and then I became a media student in the late 80s at San Francisco State, broadcasting student, and started to learn more about print media as it was going out. And then as a more recent tech, I didn't get into tech until 2016 because I was a cable guy for 17 years. So I really got to learn that part too. Hmm. And when I talk about the most important network is the human network, I was able to see through print media, through the cable companies, how they would choose, right? It was payola. And Jennifer, I'm glad you brought up gangster rap, because, you know, a recent clip with Eazy-E and KRS-One on Arsenio asked Eazy-E, what do you see this gangster rap going? And that was what, the 90s or something, late 80s? And then KRS-One chimes in, you know, the teacher, my favorite rapper, and he's like, actually, there are no gangster rappers. The real gangster is the one that owns the record company. So he turns to Eazy-E and says, so since you own the record company, you're the real gangster, right? and then, you know, so when I talk to my students, I have a thing I say, and I say, ha tech YTD. I say, remain hungry and humble. If you get an email, do you trust it? That's the T. Are you expecting that email? That's the E. The K for tech. Do you know this person? And YTD is, you're in control. Take your time, don't trust it, right? And so let's look at Cape Technologies and the VPNs, right? Virtual private networks. When we want to be private, and right, when data goes out, and you see my background, it says digital literacy. The next right. is data literacy. And that goes back to knowing the papers, knowing the media, right? And so when you look at Cape Technologies owning some of the top VPNs in the world, like ExpressVPN, CyberGhost, then they also own the the review sites for VPNs. So they're saying, use this VPN. You don't know that that person that owns the company that owns the VPN is. And that's the same thing when we're talking about music, right? So that music artist is going to get in the movie. That music artist is going to be in the periodical, yeah. Right? And so that's why I go back to saying the most important network is the human network. So when I teach my youth, to date, we have over 3,000 people with us that have graduated with 8 hours or more of digital literacy. Some of them have 8 hours, some of them have 300 hours. And this right. is why I always say, stay hungry and humble. Because this human network that we need each other, I believe, not just believe, that I know we're going to get ours. It just means we have to work harder. We have to stay connected. And so as a music artist, I know you wanted me to wear that hat as well. I got a job, right? I put out my music for free. I go out in the streets and I talk to people and we get people excited to do the shows. We push it on social media. Me personally, I don't really do social media. I have my producer do it, right? And because mm-hmm. I don't want to be there, right? And I lose that human touch. Today, I get to go out and teach one-on-one a special needs student of mine. And this guy, he wears the leather helmet, right? And he doesn't have a care in the world. He just want to be one-on-one, and I'm just going to work with him, and I'm going to learn from him. Last night, I got humbled and went back to Berklee Adult School, right? And got my, you know, just to redo my Excel and Word. And I got my little certificate. This is last night. And I jumped up like a kid because all it told me that I was willing to sit in a seat for, you know, 8 weeks for 6 hours a week. But my professor there, Professor Rosen's like, I don't even own a cell phone. I'm like, what?
Wow.
What a beautiful thing. Right. So there's ways that we can talk. And I'm not even trying to, you know, but I love KPFA so much. Because KPFA has introduced me to Project Censored. Now I can go to Project Censored and learn about the top 25 stories that have been squashed right through the corporate right. media. I now know Stephen. I know now Jennifer, right? And so we are this human network that will continue to speak. And as a musician, also getting our stuff out by hook or crook. You make it harder, the truth will come out. It always does.
I appreciate you saying that, the human network, and I want to bring Stephen from Center of Media Justice. One of the challenges that we have, and it's very intentional, and I put on my hat of being in commercial radio and remembering my bosses at Clear Channel said, make our radio station a bad habit that they can't quit, and would have us go around in the 90s to every high school in every college and say, we'll do a free party for you, right? And it's like, why are we doing that? And my bosses at the time said, by the time they're 18, they'll be fans of the station, right? By the time I left in the early 2000s, we were doing these free parties at elementary schools. We were getting mm-hmm. them hooked at a younger age. When I worked at Time Warner, you know, and remember Dick Parsons, who just passed, who was our big boss, he told us, to make sure that we reinforce learned behavior. And so I'm bringing this all up, Stephen, because one of the things that we're dealing with in these spaces is a habit, a bad habit that's hard to quit. And like it or not, people are on TikTok, which is under review and going to the Supreme Court. People are on X and various, you know, amalgamations of that, you know, owned by Elon Musk. And people are on Facebook. So let's talk about this habit that we all have, that a lot of people have. They can't quit these things. And there's a dependency. And now we're seeing that dependency being, I don't know what it's doing for people, but they're basically like, yeah, you know, now that I got you hooked, I'm gonna get rid of fact checkers. I'm going to, you know, support all kind of crazy policies. I'm going to do whatever the heck I want. And you know what, Stephen? You're still going to come on and log on every morning because you're hooked. You know, you don't have this human connection that Chris was talking about. But looking at social media and the most recent remarks from Mark Zuckerberg, where he's basically saying, we're getting rid of fact checkers and all that, I think that leaves those of us who are hooked into these platforms very, very vulnerable to who knows what. I think it's not going to be It's not going to be some outlandish lie that's told to us where they say the sky is green when it's really blue. I think it's going to be some subtle manipulations of policies and politic that, you know, maybe Latinos are the reason why grocery store prices are high. Women are the reason why that, you know, there were fires in LA, that type of stuff, where people can go, that sounds reasonable enough, and that's not going to be railed in, checked. There won't be no balances. But from the Center of Media Justice, how are you all seeing this, especially with social media now being just as popular as the net itself?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, there was a study that Pew did recently looking at where do people go to get their information? And it's the first time since they've been kind of studying this in the internet age that social media sites are about 50% of people get their information from social media sites, and the other 50% go to more traditional media. That's scary to think about, like, in the context of this moment in which, like, we're living in an information ecosystem that is so just toxic. It's not tethered to any sort of reality. And, you know, we've seen that in multiple iterations over the past few years, from the rise of, like, QAnon to the Stop the Steal movement that led to the insurrection on January 6th. So it's scary that about half the people out there are getting their information from Facebook, from X, or wherever else. And I actually felt like this came to light for me in very significant ways. I went I went canvassing in Philadelphia right before the elections, and I was talking to a lot of young Black and Brown folks, and, you know, the stories they were telling me that were kind of shaping their political realities were all just baked in with mis and disinformation, you know. So that manipulation that you're talking about is real. I think the thing we have to recognize now, especially in the context of, like, this conversation around the loss of net neutrality and what, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is doing with Meta, we have to recognize what the internet has become. You know, I think the open space that many of us as early adopters of the internet, you know, a couple decades ago, that internet is no longer the internet that exists today. You know, the internet that back in, you know, I can't remember what year it was, Davey, but when the Johannes Masurli trial was going on, the verdict, and there was the protest that happened right after that, I was following your Twitter account, like, live streaming, right, like, you know, live tweeting what was happening on
talking
the streets.
Talking about Oscar Grant, 2009, 2010, yeah.
That's right, yeah. And that's where I was going for my information. You know, you had the Arab Spring that became this kind of, like, the use of these platforms to, you know, coalesce left progressive movements in a very substantive way to, like, challenge power. That's not the world we're living in today. The internet cannot do that for us, you know, because it's not an open space anymore. It's not one click away. It's a series of fiefdoms. And Facebook, Meta, that's a fiefdom, you know, because you're talking about WhatsApp, Instagram, the metaverse. You're talking about Facebook, which has 250 million users across the world, in the US and you know, many more across the world. You're talking about other fiefdoms out there, the Amazon fiefdom, the Apple fiefdom, and the internet is primed right now to generate profit for these massive corporations. So our engagement with those platforms are all about generating data that will support their ability to, like, keep filtering towards the attention economy. So, I mean, I think that's the way we're looking at it, is it's just a further consolidation of corporate power. But it looks different today than it did a couple, right, you know, a few decades ago.
I still want to come back, and I'll also bring Jennifer and Chris, and you can chime in as well. But before we do, I still want to come back to the habit. This is a habit. In the Bay, there are about 15 websites that have dedicated themselves to dragging the Bay and replaying doom loops and basically hawking the narrative that the Bay is full of crime. And there's a similar network of sites that are well-funded in Los Angeles. Almost immediately in LA, you know, you saw the politicization of the fires coming out of those sites, Streets of LA, Hollywood Unlocked, all these different sites. It's not Hollywood Unlocked, but there's all these different names, right? A lot of them are people who ain't even from here, right? But they're front and center in terms of how their music, how their information is elevated and what they're saying. So the Karen Bass is the cause of the fires. The Democratic cities can't run correctly. All those narratives come out. She should have funded the firemen, but those were the sites that were pushing everybody to fund the police. All these different things. Mm-hmm. And you see that those narratives, not only do they take hold, but then they become a source of information for traditional media. You see what I'm saying? And they got clear pictures, unfortunately. So you're like, man, how the hell did you get these clear pictures of the fire? So you know it's well-funded, but it's a propaganda tool. So how do we start to protect ourselves against that? Because you don't even know it's a propaganda tool. You just think, you know, they're peddling anti-blackness, anti-immigrant, you know, crime and all that. And so that becomes a macabre form of entertainment. But it's got a lot of people hooked.
You're absolutely right. You know, I think way back in, I think, what was it, 2011, Facebook did this study with UCSF and with Cornell. And they were looking at, could we manipulate the emotions of our users by manipulating the content feed, you know? And the answer was yes. They found out, they learned very quickly early on, yeah, if we push certain kinds of content, it generates more engagement. Of course, it's like the outrage, the stuff that drives anger. And they took those learnings and they tweaked their algorithms to ensure that they're pushing the kinds of content that you know, expand their bottom line. I mean, it's a real scary, you know, space that we're navigating. I think how to combat it, the way we've been thinking about it is looking at where are these corporations looking to expand their power, their infrastructure. And in the internet age that we're living in today, because every major tech company is getting into the artificial intelligence game, what they need is big, big data centers, basically big computer farms to process all the data that they're collecting. And to process their large language models, the AIs that they're using. And that's a place where even Meta themselves, that's where they're spending most of their money, is to try to build new data centers. That's what Amazon is doing. And the thing with these data centers is they require a lot of land, they require a lot of water, and they require a lot of electricity. And it's going to be hard to convince people to no longer be addicted to the thing that they've been primed to be addicted to, but they will fight for access to water. They will fight for electricity in their home. They will fight because all the land is being used up. And so we're looking at opportunities where we can be fighting on the ground to stop the expansion of that infrastructure, because that is key to the increase of their power. The other thing I think that we need to be looking at is we need to be building infrastructure that is more resilient and that's not corporate owned. Every time that there's a natural disaster, and we're living it here, you know, in California and in LA, in my hometown, but also during hurricane season, this happens all the time, where a hurricane comes rolling through and guess what? Like, your cell phone doesn't work, the internet doesn't work. And, you know, I grew up in an age, you know, I grew up in LA during the Northridge earthquake, and my landline still worked, but that's because it was designed to still work. So we need infrastructure that is built to actually be resilient to the kind of world and planet that we're living in, and kind of climate that we're living in right now. And we're not going to get that if we continue to rely on these massive corporations to do that. So right. Looking at alternatives, you know, community-owned alternatives, community-built alternatives, looking at how to leverage state governments to push for policies that protect our infrastructure and make it more resilient. That's the way I think you fight these corporations, not by trying to convince people to get off the thing that they're addicted to, but instead fighting the companies where they're trying to expand on their power.
I appreciate that. That's Stephen Rendoris from Center for Media Justice. Jennifer, you wanted to add some things to this. And let me just kind of complicate this a little more, or maybe just add to this. A primary target for a lot of angst and manufactured anger is women. You see that play out with the rise of the incel class, you know, within the comic book sphere, right? And for people who don't know, it's like if Jennifer Posner, our guest, is in a movie, all of a sudden, before the movie comes out, is being tanked. That is being tanked because there is a concerted effort. There's a network of people that's like, oh, this woman's in the thing. Let's crash it out. Let's say it stinks, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not limited to some, you know, frat boys from the tech world. You see a similar type of thing with a lot of people of color that have also been rewarded for peddling anti-woman, you know, hatred and all that. So you see a lot of that. And I bring this up because it's in those spaces owned by the Elon Musk and the Mark Zuckerbergs that are allowed to float all around. So how do you see this, especially when it's happening in these fiefdoms, as Steve described?
Well, so first of all, I'm really glad that Steve was talking about these structural ways that we can make change on the much broader scale than just what the individual user can and can't do, right? But to answer your specific question, I think we also have to go back to the fact that women have always been the canaries in the coal mine of almost every problem in this society. And so, for example, you're mentioning, you know, if I'm in a movie or if I'm, you know, I could be targeted for any reason. Well, that's already happened to me. I left Twitter in shortly after Trump was elected. I left Twitter basically right after the Charlottesville march, because after about a decade of rape threats and sexual harassment and gender-based harassment pretty much every day on Twitter, that I had learned to develop a thick skin for, because every woman in public, I was actually working on a book at one point. I was going to do an anthology on sexist harassment of women on the internet, not just Twitter, as the cost of being female in public. And I started, you know, collecting things from women. I eventually stopped because I was like, at that time I lived alone and I was broke as all hell. And I didn't have the ability to deal with the OPSEC that I would need to have published that book. But I dealt with that sexist harassment every day for more than a decade online. But after Charlottesville, those same trolls started photoshopping my face onto concentration camp victims. Because they found out that I was Jewish. I don't even write about being Jewish. That wasn't my thing. That wasn't my activism. And I saw where it was going. But women were dealing with that crap for a decade before that, right? So everybody who's been leaving Twitter during Elon funding Trump and then after, if they had paid attention to what women, there were a whole task forces that I was involved with and others, Digital Sista, Shereen Mitchell, and lots of others being involved for years, trying to get Facebook, trying to get Twitter to up their moderation game. And, you know, occasionally there'd be a little bit of a win here or there, but generally they did not care about misogynist harassment, even when it was active threats with credible, images of, for example, Facebook for many years allowed images of explicit violence against women, including videos of it happening in the moment.
Yeah.
And consider that okay, right? So when Zuckerberg this week said that, you know, part of the rules now are going to be that you can call women household objects.
Yeah.
And it won't be moderated, because that's okay to call women household objects. It's okay to say that that people who are queer and trans have mental illness. That's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
So that's a huge problem. I want to, because Stephen has also already talked about the structural piece, I want to talk a little bit about, because you were asking sort of what do we do, right? I want to talk about the individual user piece with the qualification that individuals can't solve structural problems, but we can arm ourselves to become more active, critical media consumers. And so what Chris was talking about digital literacy, we need that. We need every single tip that he mentioned. And we also need sort of broader media literacy to understand and arm ourselves against disinformation and misinformation. Fact checkers are incredibly important. They're our first line of defense. If Meta is getting rid of them under these false pretenses that they had somehow control, Meta, the company, had control. They could take or not take fact checkers' suggestions, right?
Right.
So one of the first media literacy tips is don't believe self-interested corporations.
Right.
Strategies about what they're saying they're trying to get away from,
right? Especially when they rule with an iron thumb, as he does. Right. So he's acting like he's helpless dude. You get to do what you want.
Exactly. But so to add to what Chris, some of the tips Chris was mentioning earlier, I would say, and I've been saying for a long time, there are a lot of things we can do. One of the things we can do is slow it down. Every time we see something online, before we share it, ask ourselves, have we checked the source? What is the source of this? Is the source an actual journalism outlet? Is that journalism outlet one we've seen before? Could it possibly be a propaganda outlet making itself look like posing as a journalism outlet? Because that's what fake news originally was before Donald Trump co-opted it to mean anything that doesn't like Donald Trump. You know, there are fake outlets that pretend to look like journalism and look like TV and look like radio sites, but they're really propaganda either by bad actors or by corporations like Chevron and other oil companies have these fake news outlets. But in general, create for yourself a list of trusted news outlets. You know, usually it is still, at least for now, a couple of clicks away to figure out, is this source a legitimate source? Disinformation needs oxygen to spread. It needs each of us to share it, right? Don't share before you know if something's true. The other thing that I think progressives need to understand, because I see this all the time on our side, is people sharing misinformation that they know is untrue because it's funny. And they'll put their little dunks, the little caption, what kind of idiot would believe this? Ha ha ha. Or they'd make an insult, but they'd share it. The problem is people do believe it. So when we share it, we amplify it, even if we think we're mocking it, right? Don't share false information. The other thing we can do is go first. I don't think it's necessarily a problem to be on social media. I agree with you that it is addictive. I think we need to have regimens for ourselves, and it can be different for each person. Do you want to implement, I'm going to be on social media for 5 minutes every hour, or I'm going to be only one hour a day, or I'm going to do this only while I'm drinking my coffee in the morning, whatever it is, right? But we should understand what we're doing, how we're doing it, and not do it without thinking. The last thing I will say is that social media does and has had some really important positive effects. Like Stephen was saying, you know, in the past, and I think there are ways in which we can build things like that again. I don't know if Blue Sky is going to be that. It has some potential right now, but they're valuing it at millions.
I think what you're getting at, Jennifer, and this becomes something to consider, not to cut you off. Community has been built over the past 20 years. And, you know, like I know you guys primarily through community on the internet, right? And community then can be enhanced in real life, but I know you through these things. And I think that's become very scary. So let's try and disrupt these communities. Let's try and make it so vile that we get off. And so we get off and maybe we'll reconnect at another place, but there's all the other folks that you kind of know, but you don't know, that suddenly are missing. And so we have to be aware of the concerted effort on all fronts to disrupt community. And you disrupt community through false information, through propaganda campaigns, to pit people against one another, all these different things, which mean, and this comes back to something that I think you didn't say the word, but you implied it, intentionality, right? Yes. So there's got to be intentionality in terms of, I'm going to give you a phone call. I'm going to call Steven. I'm going to call Chris. There's intentionality. Why are you doing this? Because, you know, we talked offline. You're in this space, and I want to make sure that your space is interacted with Chris's space, which is interacted with Steven's space. And so there's an intentionality. Why? Because once things hit the fan, we want people to know that the universe is a lot larger, that there are these other places and spaces to go that are trusted. And so I think that is something that we can probably do individually, start to amass, these trusted sources. Go ahead.
I will also say, though, and that is so true, and we need that online and offline pipeline together to build that community. Before we dismiss internet and social media entirely as a community building tool, I think about, for example, queer kids. I think about women in domestic violence situations. I think about people in rural communities where the internet and in particular social media have been real lifelines. Or I think even, again, going back to queer or trans kids, I think about a very small website that's now been throttled by Facebook and Meta called Scarlet Teen, that is a sex ed website that is a lifeline for kids in families that would disown them if they knew. Right?
In
districts of schools where teachers aren't even allowed to say gay anymore. But they get non-judgmental sex ed from this independent, little, totally underfunded outlet online that used to be able to reach so many more people because of social media before the throttling. I think about even for myself, working from home for the majority of my adult life, running a nonprofit that never ended up getting funded, the internet was a huge community builder. We can build that offline community, but when we're connecting with people all across the country, I can't just, have coffee with Steven right now if I wanted to. I'd have to get on a plane, right? So we do need, I think, we need to do both the online and offline strategy together. Black Lives Matter would never have worked with one or the other. It was that the three women who started Black Lives Matter online were also offline organizers, right?
Right.
And it was a back and forth. And journalism, the story I told about building power in the feminist blogosphere to amplify the journalism that was already being done, that then led news outlets to start hiring women from the feminist blogosphere because they wanted our clicks, right?
Right.
That changed the nature of corporate media even to this day. And the toothpaste has been slowly being put back in the tube now, right? Bezos is firing all these journalists and et cetera. So I just think we need, when we're talking about building and solutions, we need the structural solutions that Steven was talking about. We need the digital literacy solutions that Chris was talking about. And we need to figure out how to also build ways that we can connect with local news, local community activism, both offline and online.
Appreciate you, Jennifer Posner. And Chris, let me get you to get some last words in here. With everything that's being said, and we've been talking about solutions, and I think you threw the first gauntlet with human connections. What are some next steps or things that we should be looking out for, especially as we do a dance with our younger ones?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up addiction because, my story, David D.
Right.
I'm, clean and sober 15 years, and I still go to my meetings. I'll be going to one tonight, and addiction is real, and I can identify with that. When's the last time someone put down the device and walked into the library? About 2 months ago, I went to a convention in San Diego, and I met a brother named William Wells from Kansas City, Missouri. And my brother, Jamal Malik, Jamal Williams and I are starting, or Jamal's starting, I'm assisting with it. It's a Lauren Community Innovative Technology Entrepreneurial Center at Adeline and Alcatraz, where we'll be doing digital literacy, data literacy, financial literacy, workforce development. And it's going to be loosely based on William Wells out of Kansas City, Missouri, his model called A Steam Village. And just imagine a brother in Kansas City trying to get loans from the bank to build what he thought he's trying to build get his own bandwidth. And so he couldn't. So he started buying bandwidth by these companies. He created his own infrastructure. And AST Village is teaching the young community out there. It's called District 3, the neighborhood. So when Google Fiber went there, they hired up everybody else except for District 3. I think 70% of the people were unconnected in District 3. So he built it himself with his people, teaching the community how to run fiber, how to run coax and Ethernet, and they own their own data centers. And so when he was on this panel, everybody was siloed. You were either ISP or someone like me in education or government. And he's on this panel talking and everyone's scratching their head going, wait, we can't pigeonhole you for being one part of this whole thing. And I was like, I'm taking you out to lunch. Come on. And we're connected now, right? We're going to go out to Kansas City and do some shows, right? And so on the artist front, and then he's going to help us out here doing that same thing. So how do we teach our youth, hey, to own it, own your data? As Jennifer was saying, this fight for your eyeballs, the unique visitors, right? This is the fight. And so we got to continue to talk with our youth and speak their languages. I'm glad, Jennifer, you brought that up, because what about the people in the rural communities? What about the people that are othered, right? They need that online community. And so we will continue to be on both sides of this, online and off. Go to the library, go to the park, go outside, hit the streets, right? Find best practices. And so that's how I do it. I'm just really happy and humble to be here with you, Stephen, with you, Jennifer, to know that we now have our connection and our network, and we'll continue this fight.
Yeah. How do we get a hold of you, Chris?
Lovephenomena.com. Love, L-U-V, phenomena, phenomena.com. Hit me up.
How do we get a hold of you for the Center of Media Justice?
Yeah, you can check out our website, mediajustice.org. Find us on most social websites at Media Justice, and you can find me just by my full name, Steven Renderos. On X, on Blue Sky, you can search for me on LinkedIn. Those are the places. LinkedIn and Blue Sky are going to be the places I'll probably be most active moving forward.
Okay. And Jennifer, how do we get a hold of you, and when's your book coming out?
The pub date is up in the air, but the media literacy graphic novel is coming out in the next year from First Second Books, and you can find me. Find me on Blue Sky at JennePozner, or on Facebook or Instagram for now, either JennePozner or Jennifer L. Posner.
Want to thank our guests, Jennifer Posner, Stephen Renderos, and Chris Berger. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah,
thank you.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.